welcome to another episode of Science Chat, the Science Communication Podcast, with me, Sean Marshall. One of the things that has always interested me is how science can be used as a plot construct, particularly in TV shows. I'm not talking about the use of scientific techniques in forensic investigation, so much as the use of science as a murder weapon. And of course, to make sure that the plot construct doesn't stray into science fiction, it's nice to see that most shows use science consultants. In this episode, I chat with Jennifer Woollett, director at the Science and Entertainment Exchange, an organization which helps the makers of TV programs and films to correctly use science.
Jennifer, can you tell me what the role of the Science and Entertainment Exchange is and how it works?
Well, it's a program of the National Academy of Sciences, and basically Academy President Ralph Cicerone was friends with our partners in the exchange. They're a producer-director couple, husband and wife, named Janet and Jerry Zucker. You may know them from Airplane movies and from Ghost and from some of those. Janet and Jerry have been very active in science for a long time, particularly with stem cell research in the state of California, getting legislation passed. They were friendly with Ralph Cicerone, and they decided to kind of pool their resources. I mean, Ralph felt that Hollywood could really help science get a message across, you know, get their message across better. And Janet and Jerry felt that science could help the entertainment industry have better science and better portrayal of scientists in film and television, and just give them new and innovative new ideas, you know, ways to sort of reinvigorate the genres. We've definitely seen a resurgence in American television and film of science fiction, of crime dramas that are based on science, and there's even a sitcom, Big Bang Theory, that features physicists. So there's kind of a trend towards science right now, and I guess the Academy felt it was a good time to try and tap into that. And I guess what the exchange really is what it sounds like. It's a cultural exchange program for science and Hollywood. And we do technical consulting. When writers, producers, directors call us, we will match them with scientists who have the expertise they need. But we also have salons, in-home salons and special events like screenings and panel discussions. Any way we can think of that we can get these two groups in a room together and talking and brainstorming, that's what we want to do. Because we find that when those conversations happen, that's where you're going to find the new ideas and the innovative new approaches.
And what's your role as director of the Science and Entertainment Exchange?
I kind of run the day-to-day of the program. So I do a lot of the matching. I work with our program coordinator, Rick Lovard, to plan out the ideas for the special events. And we work in conjunction with the Zuckers and with our home office back in D.C. to make all that happen. But essentially, I'm overseeing the day-to-day operations.
And on the Exchange website, it says that it relies on the resources available to the National Academy of Scientists. Does that mean that it's using the scientists that are in the National Academy?
Not precise. Yes, we do use Academy members, but we don't use them exclusively because there are a lot of younger scientists who aren't old enough to be Academy members yet because they're still making their careers. And we also want to use them as well. So we will use a mix. Basically, whoever has the expertise, we have a number of volunteers. We have access to the Academy membership. And sometimes we will seek out and recruit scientists if we've heard about them in the press or if we happen to be referred to them from one of our other scientists and they have the exact expertise that we need.
Okay, so that's how you select the experts then for a specific project. You know of these scientists, and when the project comes up, you identify a specific scientist that you think has the expertise and you approach them.
Exactly. We tend to talk to the client, for lack of a better word, the producer, the writer, the director, and find out exactly what they need. And then we have a growing database, and we see if we have someone there who fits the bill. And I should add that we do screen the scientists as well as some of the incoming clients. We want to make sure that the clients are legit, they're working on legitimate projects. And we also want to make sure that we get scientists who are legitimate scientists. I mean, they're credentialed in their field. We also look for scientists who have the skills that we think are needed for this, because not every scientist, no matter how brilliant, is going to be good at interacting with Hollywood. There's a very specific skill set. You've got to be able to communicate your research and advanced ideas in layman's terms, which many scientists are, in fact, getting better and better at. But you also have to have a sense of narrative, of story, because the way that Hollywood is going to use your input is very different. The kinds of questions that they ask are very different from, say, what a journalist would ask. they're going to want to know, well, okay, so you're studying, you know, this subject, A, can I use that to do this, you know, over here? Or I've got this plot and I'm trying to get from point A to point B and I was thinking of doing this. And if that's not possible, can you suggest a way to get, you know, plot-wise that's scientifically credible from point A to point B so that I can be scientifically credible and plausible and yet still make my story work? And so those sorts of conversations, the answers to those questions are not immediately obvious. It takes a little bit of discussion, so it takes a little bit of patience to balance the needs of good science with the needs of good storytelling. And what we're finding is that the scientists really do enjoy this process because it kind of makes them think in a new way about what they do.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the problems that people most have about scientists and scientists' ability to communicate. They're so used to thinking about their research in one particular way that they find it difficult to think about it in a way that is more interesting or more engaging with the general public.
Right, right. In Hollywood in particular, it's all about what if. You know, you've got this basic research. Could you use that to do something like this? That's kind of where, and that is a unique skill. And the nice thing is we're finding that there's plenty of scientists out there who are actually very good at it and who actually enjoy this. And what we're trying to do is bring them into the fold and introduce them to our friends in Hollywood, essentially. And ideally, you know, 20 years from now, we would like to make ourselves obsolete. We'd like to have this wonderful grassroots community that's very lively and engaged, and they won't need us anymore. So,
yeah, I read recently in a New York Times piece that you worked on an episode of the TV show Bones, which is a show that I particularly like myself, where you helped them with a plot construct using physics to kill someone. So just take me through how the consulting process on something like this works in practice.
That was actually one of the easier ones. We got a call from the showrunner, who's the head writer or producer for Bones at the time. This was a couple years ago. And he's basically said, we're trying to put together this script, this episode based on how to kill someone with physics. And we need help getting the details right. We need, you know, some input on this. So myself and one of our physicists, which is my husband, Sean Carroll, who was interviewed in the New York Times article, we went down and we met with a room full of writers who work on Bones. And so we had about six or seven of the staff writers in there, including a couple of the prop designers, the set designers, because they had to make it look right as well. It was interesting because, the kinds of questions they asked were slightly different. There was the technical aspect. How would you kill someone using physics? And we did that by essentially emailing several physicists that we knew and saying, if you were going to kill someone, how would you do it? And then the person who had the most interesting answer, Juan Collar, not only did they use his idea, but they named the fictional think tank institute in the episode after him. It's called the Collar Institute. So he was kind of tickled. But the other questions they were asking were very, very simple ones about just all of physics. For instance, they were initially going to set it at a Mensa meeting because in their minds, physicists are smart people and smart people are in Mensa. So, of course, a physicist would go to a Mensa meeting. And we were able to sit down with them and basically say, no, actually, you should probably set it at a conference or a think tank that's happening in the D.C. area, because that's much more likely to be where you're going to find groups of physicists congregating. And if a murder is going to happen, that's where it's going to happen. And then they also wanted to hear about the publisher perish attitude in academia. They wanted to know whether if someone's career was riding on a particular paper getting published and another person was threatening to pull that paper or expose them in some way, would that be motive for murder? And we said, well, probably. I mean, that would, if it was going to ruin your career and you were the sort of person to commit murder, that would be enough motivation for you. And then right down to Temperance Brennan, would her work writing popular novels hurt her professionally in any way with her academic reputation? And so they had a little subplot in that episode where she had a think tank, interdisciplinary think tank, had been denied, and because her popular writing was considered suspect. So it was very interesting to see those threads come together. And we only had 2 hours with them. And I think that, you know, some people might see the show and say, well, physics still doesn't really work that way. I thought they did a fantastic job considering they had 2 hours to absorb an entire world that they'd never been exposed to before.
So it's,
and that's the concept.
So it's very much at the initial stage. It's not as if there's actually consultants on the set while the program is being filmed or anything like that. It's just very much to develop the story.
Yes, I actually think that they do have a consultant for bones. They certainly have one for Big Bang Theory. But in the case of bones, what they were looking for with this episode was an area that was outside the expertise of their main consultant. They have a bone expert. They have a forensics bone expert who's on staff as a tech consultant. And that would be great, except that they wanted to deal with physics, and they wanted to deal with a specific way to kill someone with physics. In this case, radiation, a slow radiation poisoning. So.
Well, it sounds like a fun job being involved with. I mean, I love the idea of being involved with people who are writing TV shows and things like that.
It's actually a lot of fun to be in the room when they're having those conversations. There's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of jokes. There's a lot of, you know, people always like want to like talk more afterwards. Every time I hear, you know, people bring up the whole C.P. Snow two cultures thing, I say, you've got to see these two cultures when you get in a room together and get them brainstorming on the same idea. And you know, you see that the barriers drop at that point. There's definitely, you know, a synergy there that comes out. And so, Nat, you're right. That makes it incredibly fun.
Yeah, I have been involved in one or two meetings with TV producers brainstorming for shows. And I think when the producers, they're very much of a mind to try and get the job done and get the job right. So I think they're very highly motivated. And I think that most people, when they talk about the two cultures, they don't realize just how highly motivated these TV producers are to get this right and to make it believable.
Right, right. And there's a craft involved. And I think a lot of scientists think that they're just, you know, in a room making stuff up. And they don't understand that, in fact, there are rules. There's a way, you know, there's a way that these TV shows and these films are structured. There's a three-act structure for film, and there's, you know, a five- or six-act structure for one-hour dramas, and a completely different structure for a sitcom. And so you've got a model, and your data has to fit the model. I mean, so all that input has to somehow be worked so that it fits the model. And I think once scientists understand that and see the process in action and see how smart these writers and producers really are, it changes their attitudes. It kind of, you know, knocks their stereotypes for loop. And I think the same thing happens when Hollywood meets scientists who were young, hip, and kind of, you know, very engaging and very very good at talking about the research in a way that's understandable. So, you know, we're kind of shattering stereotypes on both sides.
Finally, I guess you must be highly tuned to seeing science portrayed well on TV, and also highly tuned to seeing it portrayed badly. Are there any examples, particularly of science being portrayed badly, that come to mind?
Yeah, everybody always wants the bad science. And I would say, you know, if you want to see a list, an exhaustive list of really bad science in film, you can go to Insultingly Stupid Movie Physics. Just Google Insultingly Stupid Movie Physics. It's an entire website devoted to dumb, bad physics done in films. I will tell you that kind of the one that gets cited the most frequently for bad physics is The Core. But the point that I always like to make when I talk about The Core is, okay, yeah, that was kind of embarrassing from a physics standpoint. But the same director, John Amiel, who did The Core, also did the Darwin biopic Creation that just came out this year. That is a lovely film, and it has excellent science in it. So in general, we try not to engage in the teasing and the skewering of bad physics in film or bad science in film and television. Because even though, you know, a writer or director might be responsible for like something like The Core that has bad science in it, who's to say that that same person isn't going to come by later and do something really good? We want to help them do something really good. If we're going to make them angry and alienate them by making fun of them, we don't want to do that, you know? So we do try and approach this in a more positive sense. We actually did a screening, an event with John Amiel on Creation, and he's marvelous. He loves science. A lot goes into making a film or a TV series, and sometimes, despite one's best intentions, it doesn't work out the way you initially intended. Just things happen along the way, decisions get made, different people give their notes and their input, and things change, and the original vision can really get warped by the time it comes out. Honestly, once you've seen exactly how many people, you saw the credits for Iron Man 2, which we also consulted on, there's 500 names there, 500 people all doing their one little piece. And there's a lot of room for error there in terms of just, you know, in terms of science getting skewed.
Yeah, well, I think if more scientists and science communicators had your attitude that rather than trying to knock when they see it being done badly, rather than trying to knock it, actually try to get involved and to try to make it better and to engage with them is a much better way to deal with it. And on that note, I'd just like to thank you, Jennifer, and we look forward to seeing your involvement in some more TV hits.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this episode. Science and Entertainment Exchange can be found on www.scienceandentertainmentexchange.org. That's all one word. And you can find Jennifer's blog on www.jenniferwoolf-writes.com. As usual, you can find links to this Science Chat episode and others on my blog, www.sciencechat.net/wordpress, where you can comment on the episodes or on anything else you see there. Until next time.